Let me try to fill you in briefly and rely on you to give me some signals if I do it too briefly. This particular series of sessions is called Religion and Experience. And what we have been assuming as our common basis of thinking together is that we do not have direct experience of God in the way that we have direct experience of one another or of other things. I can see that you are here in a direct way. Now, I know that raises a lot of questions as well, but I'm for our purposes, I'm bypassing all of those and saying that in some way we have a direct experience of one another that is different from our direct experience, from our experience of God. As a result, we need to think about God, to speak about God, in language that uses analogies, that compares God to something else. And the example of this that I tried to use on Thursday is that while I know you're here, there are many things that I do not know about you. While I can see you sitting there, I do not know what is going on inside each and any one of you unless you give me some clues to that. When you give me those clues, I can give meaning to those because I can say, well, I too have felt like that. And what I am really saying is I have feelings that I describe with the same kind of language. And I have feelings that help me understand the signals that I get from you. Now, I may or may not understand what's going on inside of you. My analogies may be good analogies, or my analogies may be bad analogies. Coming from the North, we live in South Carolina, and going into South Carolina, almost any place you go, when you leave, they have a standard phrase, which is, you all come back now. Here? That's a little heavy accent. Even my accent isn't very good. But and you say, oh my, isn't that very nice? Every place we go, we have an invitation to come back. And emphasized by you, you listen now, you hear? Of course, if you do come back, they are surprised. Because that isn't what it means. That's a way of terminating, of ending. And sometimes people like you to come back, but not always. And you just can't go on the basis of that. Now, if you say that to somebody in Minnesota, you're more likely to expect them to come back. Yeah, you be sure and come back and see us again. Well, that's more likely to mean something. So you have to have analogies in your own experience that will help you understand. The same is true of anger or loving. I can understand and interpret the angry signals that I get from you because I know something about my own anger. and I can interpret the loving signals that I get from you because I know something about my own loving feelings. And that already makes communication between us who have direct experiences of one another a more complicated process. Now, we know how easy it is to miss connections with one another and assume that there is understanding when we're using the wrong analogy. Now, when we communicate to one another about our experience of God and our relationship to God, we are using similar analogies. And I have suggested that the most meaningful analogies that we use for our relationship to God are analogies from interpersonal relationships. And that our understanding of our relationships to God, and perhaps even our relationships to God, are formed and shaped by the most significant interpersonal relationships that we have. We've called those primal analogies. That is, those relationships which shape and form our relationships, other relationships, as well as form and shape our language and our that we use in communicating about relationships. And we talked last on Tuesday and Thursday about two kinds of analogies that we use for thinking about our relationship to God. One is our primal experience of trust, and the way in which we learn to trust our parents primarily, but also other people. And on Thursday, we reflected some about our experiences of the realities of the world in which we live and the difficulty that all of us experience in adjusting our wishes and hopes and dreams to those realities. And the way in which our parents helped us to adjust to the realities of the world in which we live, including their own reality. That is, a question as to whether or not our parents gave us very clear signals about what they would let us do or were willing to tolerate or could handle at the moment, and what kinds of experiences of autonomy and frustration we bring out of our own life experience to our relationship with God. And as we talked about that, some people in the group were felt ready and willing to share something out of their own experience. Want to emphasize, though, that we, while that is very, very helpful and is the stuff with which we're working in this session, that you need not, you should not feel under any obligation to share or feel that you need to share any of your own experience for us to fulfill our purposes in this group. Certainly welcome that, and is very useful, but we are not also not depending on that, because we're talking about things that it is sometimes difficult and painful to talk about, and we're also talking about some things which you may at the moment not particularly want to think about in terms of your own experience. So we want you to have some freedom in what you do and some control over what happens to you here. So if you find that what we're talking about raises some anxieties or concerns for you, you may want to just sit back and look at the experience of some other people. I'd like to then stop and ask if there are questions. Yeah.
Well, starting with the hypothesis that we do not have direct experience with God isn't where I'm at, so I don't know if I can start there, unless what you're trying to say is that we deal with human beings maybe in the soul realm rather than as we communicate with God through our spirit, which is then born, made alive so that we can communicate with Him directly. Are you saying then that when we communicate with human beings, it's with our mind, our emotions, not with our spirit?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I would say that, first of all, that a lot of our communications about and our understanding of our relationships to other people as well can only be expressed in terms of analogies.
Something that we've experienced so we can relate to it.
Right. So if you if you have someone who has grown up and in the process of growing up has never experienced very much love, that person will not have any way of knowing the kinds of love and concern that can actually be expressed in the human situation. In other words, that will be a limitation on that person. But whatever our experiences have been, there is for all of us that first basic experience, which experience of being loved, that experience of being frustrated, that experience of being helped to live with reality, came to us for the first time when we had nothing to compare it with. Now, that would be I'm suggesting that is the source of our analogies. Now, I also heard you say that you would be more inclined to speak about a direct experience of God than I would.
Well, I feel like that is there, so I can't start out saying it's not there unless you're just wanting to ignore it for the purpose of seeing relationships with people and communication with people as different than that.
There is some difference between the experience. Could we agree that there is some difference between the experience that we have of God and the experience that we have of other people? That difference is what I'm trying to express in the difference between direct and direct experience and not having direct experience.
Would you say that it would be beneficial for a person to have a very wide range of different types of experience? I think particularly you may be talking in the feeling level. In order to be able to identify with and relate to other people that have many different types of experiences.
Right.
Someone who has not had much experience might not be able to relate to someone who has a different feeling than he or she has.
In the two previous sessions, we've talked about the difficulty that we have in understanding one another when we speak about our religious experience, because each of us is speaking out of our own set of personal analogies, and it's awfully easy to assume that we know the analogies out of which the other person is speaking, and therefore I do not need to make an effort to clarify those. We talked, for example, about used as an example the very common religious language of speaking of God as Father, and the fact that people have many different experiences of fathers, and that on the, so that when we're talking about God as Father, we're evoking many different associations in different people, and that we very often do not clarify this. On the other hand, that the other possibility is that we speak of God as the only relationship in which we really experience consistent, perfect fathering, and all other relationships with fathers are to be measured by that standard. So you can look at it either way. But we really don't know very much about fathering except from our own experience of either being fathered or being fathers or observing fathers in action. So that language about God as Father is going to be very closely related to whatever our experiences have been. I don't see God dealing with people as his children in the way that I see parents dealing with their children in the dining hall and so forth. I see things happening to people, and I have my own understanding of what God is doing, but I really don't get any clues in a particular situation. I don't get any clues from God.
Sure, but I understand that last one. You don't get any clues from God
as to
what, how we as parents should father.
Yeah. Children? Well. Yeah. Well, that would be one way of looking at it. The other way is that when I see, when I look at a person's life, I say that person is in a relationship to God. I can see what the person is doing. But I cannot see what God is doing.
We'll let you go on. I'm still not quite.
Okay.
Where you're at, but you probably have more to go.
No. Well, it's a. I don't want to just run away from the question, because you're the first person who has raised it, and I suspect that there are other people who have had it and haven't raised it.
Well, I guess my question at that point would be, therefore, what?
Therefore.
Once you arrive at the point that our ideas of fathering have come from what we have seen, what we've experienced, and what we're now becoming as parents.
Mm-hmm. That it is extremely important for us in exploring our own religious experience and in communicating with other people about it, to explore the basis of the analogies out of which we speak. Because, for example, when I speak of God as my Father, as Father, and think about the other experiences of fathers that I have, what I may say is, in some ways God is like those fathers, and in some way God is not like those fathers. And until I clarify those distinctions for myself, my language about God as Father is going to evoke some feelings, but they're going to be largely unexamined feelings. There are people who, for example, are quite uncomfortable with praying the Our Father, because the experiences and the feelings which that refers to are negative feelings for them.
So your point is then to examine it, realize that it's a negative feeling, so that we can understand our own feelings, and then in order to change our concept of God, to say God is not like the Father that I have experienced, or God is like the Father that I've experienced in this area.
That may happen. But we're not trying to lay down any prescription. We're simply saying that exploration might be of some value for some of us. The other two sessions are on tape, so
I've heard them.
Oh, you've heard them. Okay. You were here.
Yes.
Oh, okay. I'd like to focus on a set of experiences this morning that come when we're 5, 6, 7 years old. A set of experiences that come when there's a transition out of the period of childhood in which our concern is to prove that we can do what we want to, or to prove that we don't have to do what we don't want to. And we begin, it becomes a point in our lives where that is no longer so important. Things are beginning to settle down a little bit, and our activity, at least from the outside, observed from the outside, seems to begin to have some purposes. We are starting to do things and putting things together in order to accomplish tasks, in order to achieve goals. It's not just a matter of pleasing or not pleasing, conforming or not conforming, but we begin to have some our own sense of inner direction. And I wonder if as you think back to your own childhood or to children whom you have known, if you can begin to picture that kind of transition. It's a very important transition in life, and one of the most difficult to negotiate. The reason being is that when I begin to set purposes for myself and work to achieve goals, which may be realistic or unrealistic, I become aware of the reality of evil in my life in a new way. When I'm 2 and 3, even when I'm 1 year old, as you can just see by observing a child, or our child, the emphasis is on I can do what I want to, whether you want me to or not, and it's all tied up in either submission or rebellion, pleasing, not pleasing, conforming or not conforming. But when I can have learned that I can do what I want to within certain limits of reality, I begin to become aware of the quality of things that I want to do, and begin to be aware that some of the things that I want to do are good, and some of the things that I want to do are not good. Not just because they conform or do not conform to what my parents want, but because I begin myself to recognize that some of the things which I feel myself wanting to do are things which I also do not want to happen. So I begin to develop a conscience. I want to do this, I don't want to do this. I begin to get begin to be involved in dialogue with myself. And it's at that point that I then begin have the possibility of becoming guilty, of wanting to do something, of knowing that it's wrong, even knowing that part of me doesn't want to do it, and yet feeling I'll go ahead and do it anyhow. That experience, it seems to me, is the basic experience of being guilty. And Christians have generally recognized that you cannot be guilty without knowing what you wanted to do and wanting to do it. Now, there are ways in which I hide my knowledge from myself and ways in which I hide my willingness from myself. But I cannot be guilty without some sense of both willing something to happen and knowing the consequences. Now, for many Christians, this becomes the definition of sin. So, one of the things I would like to draw your attention to is the possibility that for many of us and for many religious people, the basic definition of sinfulness and of involvement in sin is a guilt-oriented definition. Our basic analogy for sin is guilt. As though there were no experience of the reality of evil and no involvement in the sinfulness of the world in which I live before I could be guilty. Now, there are some Christians who are very, very consistent on that point, and who say that the question of sin and the question of salvation and the grace of God is not a real question until you are 6 or 7 years old. Okay. So these people say, we really have no ministry to people until they have reached this age in which they can really be guilty. So people say, we, for example, do not baptize infants, and that doesn't bother us at all, because sin does not become a reality until you come to this point. Now, that obviously is not the tradition out of which most of us come, as I have learned to know you. Not all of us are Lutherans. Many of us are. And we represent a different tradition which says that sin is a reality for us from the time that we come into existence. And we call that original sin. But our difficulty is, for some of us, as I have, is that we then try to describe that reality in terms of guilt. Now, one of the things that I have been trying to explore in the two previous days, is that the reality of evil in the world in which we live, and the reality of evil in ourselves, is experienced in other ways than guilt. So I can be involved in sin and can experience the bondage of sin even if I am not guilty at a particular point. I may experience it as a situation in which I am not able to trust God because of the kinds of realities that I experience in the world. Realities which I have not caused, which I have not willed, which I really don't even necessarily understand, but which impinge upon my life. And I may experience it as a difficulty in understanding the nature of the reality in which I live and being obedient to that reality. There are many things in which the question is not whether I am guilty, but whether I am adequate to life. I've been using a lot of analogies in these sessions about raising children. And I would think that there are many times as a parent in which I am doing the best I know how to do and doing the best I can. And that's the way in which I function as a parent most of the time. Okay. But then when I see my children growing up, I can also see that even though I did the best that I knew, the best that I was able to do, it didn't quite turn out the way I wanted it to. Now, one way of looking at that is to go back and say, well, is to explore myself and try to find ways in which I was guilty. And there are times, and there are ways in which I am guilty over against my children. Okay. I do become angry, and I do things which I also don't want to do. But most of the time, I'm doing the best I can. And you know, my teenagers always speak to you very, very openly and honestly about what kind of a parent you were. And they pick out some of the things which I thought were the best. Huh? I thought, boy, I was really, really doing it well. And they say, well, that wasn't so good. No? And I did the same for my parents. Remembering back to my own adolescence, I was particularly aware of the inadequacies of my parents as parents. And it was important that I was, because I had to live with those inadequacies. And I know that my sons are, my teenage sons, are also aware of my inadequacies. Now, that, it seems to me, those two experiences, the experiences of coming up against evil that is there as a reality in the world and which makes it difficult for me to trust, or coming up against the reality of my own inadequacy when I'm really at my best, are two experiences of evil that Lutherans speak about as every bit as much the reality of sin in the world as the experiences that are associated with guilt. Okay? Now, one of the things that happens in our religious communications is that when we define, that we sometimes get caught in talking about sin as though we could only experience the reality of sin when we were guilty. We are, in effect, find ourselves saying to people, we have a gospel for you if you have been guilty. So if you don't particularly feel guilty, go back home and womp up some feelings of guilt. Right? And when you come back, we'll be able to give you the gospel. But if you don't, you know, if you don't have any guilt, we really can't help you. Now, that kind of thing, I think, sometimes comes through in popular preaching and in conversations of Christians with one another, that we feel that this experience of guilt is the only possible experience of the reality of evil, and is the only one that really counts. Now, what I'm suggesting is that it's important for us to analyze and be aware of our basic analogies for the experience of guilt. First of all, so that we do not try to make guilt our basic concept for the experience of sin. I think that the experience of sin in terms of the massive realities of life that make it difficult to trust, or the experience of sin in terms of our own inadequacy, are much more common experiences of sin for many people than guilt is. The people with whom I work and the people whom I know, this is true. It is true that I do in fact become guilty, that I know what I'm doing and I know that it's wrong and I know what the consequences will be and I want to do it anyhow and I do it and I'm guilty. And that's an experience. But that's for most of us, that's not a constant, regular, ongoing experience. So I want to set some limits to the analogy of guilt. But having done that, then, I would like to explore with you some of the ways in which guilt gets in the way of the development of our interpersonal relationships, and to ask if these are meaningful analogies for the ways in which our guilt gets in the way of the development of our relationship to God, and to explore what forgiveness might mean. in that context. Now, whether we'll be able to do all of that or not, I don't know. I always like to stop and pick up reflections or comments.
I have an experience from the time that I was in primary grade in Sunday school. I was given some pennies to put in the collection. I didn't put them all in. When I came home, I went down to the store and bought some candy. I came home, and my father said, "Where did you get that?" I had to tell him. So he sent me up to my room and asked me to ask God for forgiveness. And I think that's a good way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
He explained, of course, that this money really belongs to God.
So it's let me say, that's not an uncommon experience. When I went to Sunday school, we too took the collection, and you took it in your hand. And that, of course, I think was possibly leading into temptation. An experience not only of children in Sunday church school, but it's a particularly difficult temptation for any of the people who handle money in the church. And some of you may have experiences of this at different levels. But it is, I think, that the juxtaposition of the temptation to take something that doesn't belong to us with all of the questions and tensions and conflicts of our relationship to God makes that a particularly powerful temptation. It's taking what belongs to God becomes an act of quite a different quality, as your father indicated, than taking what belongs to borrowing a penny out of the change from the grocery store on the way home. And it's interesting that your father didn't say that the money which you took belonged to the people who had given it to you to put in the offering, but that it already belonged to God. And now that is an experience, and it is a not uncommon experience. What are some, would you like to look at that a little bit? Okay. How old were you?
Imagine about 6.
And it was very, very important to, it seemed very important to have that for yourself. Can you remember enough of the experience to know whether you were aware that that was something you shouldn't have done?
I feel that I did it on purpose. I kept that money because I would want to go with my candy.
And that was your purpose. How do you think God would have, looking back on it, how do you think God would have felt about your purpose?
Well, it was a very form of selfishness. And I feel that I definitely knew that I was doing wrong. And I feel too that part of it was the fact that I would go up to a girlfriend and ask her to go with me to the store and ask her to get the thing. She got it the right way, and we together went down. And I feel probably that I wanted someone else to go with me, as I did.
Mm-hmm. When you think about the so you wanted, you didn't want to be alone.
No.
But when you think back to it, and you spoke of you're doing it on purpose, I'd like to explore this analogy of purpose. One of the ways in which you described the purpose was the purpose of getting the candy with God's money. Let me try and empathize with that a little bit. Okay? I think we're probably pretty much from the same generation. When I was growing up, there wasn't much candy. Right? And candy was a real treat. Okay? And when my parents wanted to show to me that they really liked me or really approved of me, they would give me a penny for candy. Now, that didn't happen very often because there just weren't that many pennies around. Okay? But it really meant something for me about being loved and about being special. When we think about the purpose of doing of that kind of thing, then I think that we need to take that whole dimension into account in understanding the purpose. In other words, the purpose was not just to get any candy, because you would not have walked into the grocery store and taken it off the counter. Although, you know, children do that too, but that's not what you were experiencing. What you were experiencing was the desire to have some sign of God's love. And to go to the grocery store with my parents' penny and get candy is a sign of God's of my parents' love. To go to the grocery store with God's penny and get candy is an experience of God's love. And so I think that's part of the powerfulness of that kind of temptation, which, as I've said, I think is a particularly powerful temptation for anyone who has contact with God's money, that they think of as God's money. Because it is, the purpose is to get some confirmation that I am loved by God in a special way. And in order to get that, I will do something which I, even while I'm doing it, understand is wrong. If you remember, this as something that happened when you were about six. You know, when, how many children were there in your family? May I just ask?
Four.
And you were the oldest?
No, second oldest.
Second oldest, okay. One of the things which I was particularly concerned about when I was six, and that many people are particularly concerned about, is to have some sign that they are specially loved by a particular parent. Usually the parent of the opposite sex. So at that point that girls become daddy's girls, and boys are particularly attached to their mothers. And the feeling that that I want to be special for this parent. I want this parent to give me all of their love, all of their attention. That's a fairly common experience, which many of us have and which we tend to forget as we grow older, but which many people are able to remember. And want to have some sign that this particular parent loves us. That is why children at that age begin to feel that sometimes begin to feel that they need to do something very, very special, very unusual, in order to have the certainty that that parent really loves them. Because there are a lot of other people around him who are whom that parent also seems to care about. So you need to have some sign of there being something special. So it's not at all uncommon for children at this point to take something that belongs to that parent that they want to be especially close to. Because that then becomes a sign of love. But it's a particularly difficult sign of love, because we also know that the parent didn't give that to us. We took it for ourselves. So we now have this purpose of wanting to have the love of that parent, okay? Which is good, right? It's a good goal. But it's also a tainted goal, because we want to have that parent for ourselves in a special way, which excludes other people. And we know that's not quite right. And we then try to achieve that by doing something that we know is wrong. And it's a very good and clear example of the experience of the way in which purposefulness in life involves us in guilt. Okay? Now, let me give you some other experiences. Some of us smiled and nodded as you were telling your story. So we know it's not just your experience alone. Some of us may also have the experience of can also remember that at this time, when we had this sense of purpose, of wanting this parent to be special for us, to be there for us in a way that no one else was, of thinking about other people not being there, at this point, boys sometimes dream of their fathers dying. Little girls sometimes dream of their mothers dying. And not because they really don't want them around, but because they want the opportunity of being special for that particular parent. Some of you who have children may remember some things that your children suddenly began to talk about or say to you, and questions that seem to come out of nowhere when children are five, usually when they're six, suddenly they come up and say, what would happen to us if you died? You say, well, I'm not thinking of that. Oh, well, I am. Of course, they don't say that. Well, it just, of course, we know that it won't happen. But what would happen to us? Or they will come to, a boy will come to his mother and say, well, if anything would happen to Dad, I would take care of you. Any kinds of, am I striking any responsive chords in your experience? You see, there the, if you've taught Sunday school, you know that there is suddenly that point when children come out of nursery school and they're about 6 years old and suddenly they want to talk about all of the deep theological questions. They suddenly have, they don't want to do the scissors and paste stuff anymore and the coloring. They want to talk about God and they want to talk about death and they want to talk about forgiveness. That suddenly becomes meaningful to them. Because they're beginning to experience how, they're beginning to have that experience of human life in which our purposefulness involves us in the experience of being guilty. And those are powerful experiences. Now, some people, never overcome that experience. You have the sense that their lives really don't have any purpose. It's hard for them to get a sense, it's hard to get any sense of direction or purpose out of what they're doing. And very often, pastorally, what one finds is that there is an unresolved sense of guilt out of this purposefulness. You know, maybe they took the penny out of the collection plate, and we all have jokes about that, right? About taking more out than we put in and so forth. We all are familiar with that. They have the sense that that happened to them, but they didn't have the good fortune to be discovered. And so nobody told them about forgiveness. Now your father seems to have reacted very calmly and didn't get all excited, didn't tell you you were, but he could have reacted differently, couldn't he? He could have said, you're going to hell, you know, right? And you're no child of mine. You do that again, we'll send you to the orphanage. He could, and parents do that. He could have reacted out of his own anxiety and could have been a very, very difficult experience. He said, for you to go upstairs and to ask God for forgiveness. So he also left you with some doubt, perhaps, as to whether or not you really would be forgiven. You can ask God. I don't know, you know, your father says, you know, you didn't steal from me, you stole from God. God's going to have to forgive you. But how's God going to forgive you? But he was kind of hedging his bets a little bit. And so what, you know, when God talks about forgiveness, and when the gospel talks about forgiveness, it's talking about not just about forgiveness for what we've done to other people, but it's also God saying to us, you are forgiven for the things you have done against me. So you should not have any doubt about that forgiveness. But you could have been left with some doubt. And you can see how now, suppose that if you take a person now who who has that experience of becoming guilty when I begin to have a sense of purpose in life. You have a person who is going to feel that the way for me to be righteous, the way for me to stay out of sin, is not to try to accomplish much. And then even to feel that it's particularly pious not to try to accomplish very much. See, out of that feeling that I need to avoid becoming guilty.